Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to give you that shortcut to knowledge, focusing on something really specific, but quite revealing about modern culture. We're looking at how corporate incidents, you know, the kind of crises that flare up and then seem to vanish from the news, how they don't actually disappear. Instead, they sort of freeze. They become these hard, enduring cultural myths.
Exactly. And for you, our listener, seeking that deep, structured understanding, we've got, well, quite the collection of sources today. We're digging into official recall notices, some confidential memos, medical reports from the early 90s, and basically three decades of cultural chatter around one single object, the Grow Guy toy from 1996.
Yeah, and our mission here is to trace that collision point, you know, the exact moment where the corporate containment effort, the cold hard facts meant to provide certainty, close the book, just completely fails to account for that human need for an explanation for the stories people tell, the lingering witnesses, the rumors, and that terrifying little statistical gap they called the 0.1%.
It's a real masterclass in information control, and ultimately its failure.
Yeah.
And to really get the collapse, you first have to understand the rise. Looking back at the marketing for Grow a Guy in 96, I mean, it was the absolute definition of innocent nationwide fun, but maybe inherently a bit disturbing in what it promised.
Oh, the allure was immediate, almost irresistible for a kid back then. It wasn't marketed like a chemistry set or some silly gag gift. No, this was presented as instant companionship, low effort magic, really. The ads were everywhere, saturated daytime TV, promising this transformation. All you had to do was drop it in and watch the magic start.
Right. It played directly on that core childhood feeling of anticipation, you know?
Yeah.
The idea that you just wait a little while, something amazing will happen.
Yeah.
The mechanism reports say it was just simple polymers absorbing water, nothing too fancy chemically, but the experience.
Yeah.
That was pitched as something else entirely. You put the small, sort of dry figure into a bowl of water, and the reports really emphasize this part. It would immediately fizz, it glows, it grows overnight.
And the whole experience was built around that morning check-in, that moment of revelation, the big payoff that absolutely hooked the market was seeing the final form. Just boom, a brand new buddy, bigger than life.
And that detail, bigger than life, combined with the final tagline.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so critical and maybe a little eerie. Because it instantly shifted the frame from just a toy to something more, a companion, the line that ended every single commercial, the one that sold millions of these things. It was so definitive.
Yeah.
He's real.
Wow. And that initial sense of wonder, that massive product hype,
yeah. It
turned into public safety alarm with, well, terrifying speed. It felt like it went from being the must-have toy to a national threat almost overnight. That sudden shift, that's our starting point for Phazon. The alarm and the recall mechanics.
And we really need to stress, this wasn't just a minor safety update or a tweaked warning label. The sources are clear. This was a full-scale crisis management situation. The recall notice was immediate, it was sudden, and it demanded a complete urgent purge of the product from every shelf, every home, every warehouse, nationwide.
Yeah, and the sources are frankly chillingly vague about why. What exactly was the harm? That lack of specifics only seemed to amplify the public panic. The only thing authorities would confirm repeatedly was the severity. The toy was officially linked to some very serious crimes and serious incidents across the country, which implies harm way beyond, you know, a typical choking hazard or something.
Mm-hmm. The language they used, the public health officials at the time, it was textbook crisis communication.
Mm.
It prioritized removal, action, over explanation. Get it out of circulation now. It was designed purely to instill urgency, not really to inform. The reports were just unequivocal of it immediately. Authorities say the item may pose a serious risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that silence, the not knowing what the risk actually was, that might have been the most frightening part of the whole thing for people.
Right. And this level of immediate mandatory compliance, this is where we bring in one of our key deep dive lenses. It links this corporate system failure straight back to our analysis of the monopoly files we discussed before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Remember when we talked about monopoly? We explored how the game sort of trains the player, gets you to internalize an accepted system's debt, compliance, before you even realize the game itself is fundamentally fixed against you. The system demands obedience to its rules, even if those rules seem absurd or, you know, actively harmful.
And the parallel here is sharp. It's quite disturbing, actually. The Grow a Guy toy trained the consumer for magic, promised this amazing reward, a new friend, a real one, and then suddenly, systemically, bam, the trap is revealed. The corporation created this expectation of life, of wonder, and then what followed was this absolute demand for immediate, unquestioning obedience to deal with a massive system failure.
Good. Consumer was forced to switch gears instantly. One minute you're an eager participant in this magical experiment, the next you're just an obedient agent in a huge corporate and regulatory cleanup operation. They were basically told, whatever you bought, whatever we promise you, forget it, destroy it. Now, that abrupt shift in the command structure, that's a psychological hit that often gets overlooked in these big recalls.
Just the logistics of the containment effort alone tell you how serious the regulators took this. The sources detail this exercise in mass recall and destruction. It was apparently unparalleled in toy safety history back then. This wasn't some slow trickle-back inventory issue. No, this was an urgent, all-hands-on-deck push to literally eliminate every trace of the product.
Yeah, think about the sheer institutional resources needed for that kind of operation. When the government moves with that level of speed and severity, I mean, actions usually reserved for, like, contaminated food or seriously defective medical devices, it instantly cranks up the public's perception of the threat. It suggests something truly, truly outside the bounds of normal risk assessment.
Which brings us neatly to our micro takeaway for this first phase. Even something seemingly harmless, a cheap childhood toy sold in a grocery store aisle, can be instantly redefined as a major public menace, triggering a level of regulatory action that really underscores the hidden systemic seriousness of whatever those reported incidents actually were.
And the ultimate goal for the regulators, it was simple, on paper at least, achieve total closure. They absolutely needed to deliver a definitive statement of success, something to quell the panic, remove the item from the cultural conversation, and frankly, prevent the exact kind of mythology we're dissecting right now from ever taking root. Okay, so that quest for certainty, for the final word, brings us straight into phase two. And this part pivots entirely on one single, incredibly specific number that the authorities used to try and close the file. After weeks of this intense nationwide effort, they held a final press conference. This was meant to be it. The final, unshakable word on the matter.
This is that critical moment, right, where containment tries to stamp out confusion. The official tally they released to the media, it was delivered with this absolute precision, this bureaucratic certainty. The goal was clearly to demonstrate unprecedented success, total control.
So authorities stood up there, faced the cameras, and stated, as of this evening, we have successfully located and destroyed 99.9% of all known Grow-A-G units. Short, quiet pause. And that number, that exact number, 99.9%. That's precisely where the corporate narrative, the official story, just fractures beyond repair. They were trying so hard to provide absolute certainty, you know, shut down any doubt. But the very nature of that specificity, that tiny gap between 100% and 99.9%, it becomes mathematically terrifying when you're talking about a product linked to serious incidents.
It forces an immediate, almost anxious pivot in your thinking. Okay, if they were successful with 99.9%, then you have to focus on the tiny bit they missed. What about the 0.1%? Yes. The human mind just can't see 99.9% success in this context without instantly calculating the potential costs of that 0.1% failure.
Right. And look, from a purely practical, logistical view, 99.9% success in a national recall like that is phenomenal. It should have been hailed as this incredible regulatory triumph. But context is everything. In the context of a mystery product, one that was marketed with the tagline, "He's real," that tiny fraction, just one in every 1,000 units unaccounted for, becomes a perfect quantifiable seed for an urban legend to sprout.
So the official claim didn't contain the story at all. It actually amplified the failure point. The narrative gap, the space for myth, exists precisely because absolute containment failed. By claiming near total success, they officially, publicly, definitively documented their own systemic failure to account for everything.
And this connects directly to our analysis of Klaus Richter, remember him, Der Schatten. His whole story revolved around informational erasure. Richter wanted to vanish completely from black ops records. But the sources showed that every attempt to delete his file failed because the record of the deletion attempt itself remained. The system logged the erasure.
It's the exact same mechanism here. Richter's official deletion ended up proving the existence of the secret operations he was part of. It left a trace. Here, the official success claim, we got 99.9%, only highlighted and, in a way, legitimized the existence of the official failure, the missing 0.1%. The very act of erasing the 99.9% became the statistical proof that the remainder existed and was still out there unaccounted for.
They basically formalized the missing units. They gave the public anxiety a number, a quantifiable home. They stated definitively, there is a fraction of this dangerous thing still loose.
Yeah.
And because the original source of the danger was kept so vague, so unspecified, that anxiety had infinite room to grow and fester.
And then that fear, that 0.1% anxiety, was just allowed to settle. to sink beneath the surface for decades. After the initial media frenzy died down, the incident faded, became, as the sources put it, a thing of the past. A massive gap opens up, roughly 30 years pass, and this kind of cultural amnesia takes hold.
It's really important to dwell on that silence for a moment. An entire generation grew up with zero context for the original panic. Maybe they heard vague, unsettling rumors from parents about some bad toy from back in the day, but nothing concrete. The image of the fizzing, glowing thing just faded, undisturbed. It existed only as whispers, or maybe as that nagging, quantifiable doubt point, 0.1%.
And what's really interesting, I think, is how the ordinary domestic setting actually amplified the myth's potential. These missing units weren't lost in some secure government warehouse. They were potentially sitting in people's attics, in basements, at the back of closets. So the possibility was always lurking there that maybe one unit just grew quietly, undisturbed, for 30 years.
Yeah, that decades-long silence isn't really the absence of fear. It's more like the fear crystallizing, settling into the background lore, becoming part of the foundation of suburban memory, just waiting for the perfect trigger to resurface and prove all those old whispers true.
And the trigger, as the sources report it, finally arrived in 2026, about 30 years after the recall, which throws us straight into phase three, the wellness check and the discovery. And the scenario couldn't be more perfect for staging the uncanny, right? The absolutely ordinary setting hiding something extraordinary, a system failure coming home to roost.
The setting is just crucial for the horror to really land. A quiet, completely unremarkable suburban house, the kind you drive past every single day without a second glance. Sources say the police were initially just doing a mundane welfare check, routine stuff. Neighbors hadn't seen someone, reported unusual activity, whatever. The expectation was paperwork, maybe a sad situation, but not this.
But yeah, routine went out the window the moment they found him. The initial reports filtering out were confused, chaotic, and utterly chilling. A reporter live at the scene confirmed the basics. A horrible crime has taken place in this house behind me. Authorities were cagey about the specifics of that crime, but they did confirm a man was taken into custody in connection with, let's say, the human element of the investigation.
But the truly shocking discovery, the one that blew the whole thing wide open again, wasn't the crime itself. It was the secondary finding. This non-human entity found inside the house. Officers on scene initially just described something that looked basically like a human-shaped figure. Nothing more specific at first.
Then came the official medical assessment, released after, presumably, some very specialized examination. Mm. And the phrasing here is what just slammed this incident right back into the 1996 narrative. It forced the entire regulatory system to confront its three-decade-old failure. Doctors confirmed, with absolute certainty apparently, that the entity discovered had no pulse, no heartbeat.
And then the definitive conclusion, released by an official regulatory source, confirming everyone's worst latent fears. He was not even human. Further digging into the house records, the family history, it concluded that this entity had been hiding, surviving, in that same house alone since 1996, the exact year it was given to the family as a gift. It was definitively, undeniably, one of the missing 0.1%.
Wow. So that single discovery instantly invalidated 30 years of government assurances, right? Yeah. The fear wasn't just hypothetical anymore. The missing unit hadn't just disappeared. It had survived, undetected, and apparently grown to adult dimensions over a generation.
And then the sources reveal the detail that is both the most horrifying and, in a strange way, the most mundane part of its survival. The specific mechanism that allowed it to persist, hidden in a regular house. And this detail is absolutely crucial because it makes the impossible feel real. It grounds the legend in the everyday.
The entity, reportedly, survived by slipping beneath the water in the bathtub unseen each night to sleep. That image. It provides such a chilling, vivid, domestic picture of its hidden life. It suggests this patient, slow, maybe quasi-biological process of regeneration, perhaps needing the very water that originally fueled its growth cycle back in 96.
Yeah, the bathtub mechanism. It's a perfect example of the uncanny valley applied to object survival, isn't it? The horror comes from something that looks recognizably human or human-shaped, operating on some completely alien, maybe mechanical logic, performing a basic life function, sleeping but in the most ordinary of settings, porcelain tub. It was life, or something like it, hiding in plain sight by co-opting a common household object.
And as soon as that discovery hit the public sphere, you could just see the information control, the kind that defined 1996, immediately fragment. The official bulletin tries to reassure, stay factual, but the neighborhood rumor mill, armed with sensory details. It just works faster and sticks harder in the mind.
Mm. What really stands out here is how quickly the fear becomes tactile, visceral.
Okay, so here's the contrast. Authorities confirm non-biological entity found during welfare check, cause of death unrelated to the discovery.
But neighbors say the creature moves like old plastic in the humidity, smelling faintly of chlorine.
See, that rapid exchange perfectly illustrates the myth-making process in action. The official statement tries to compartmentalize, minimize. Okay, entity found, but it's unrelated to the crime, move along. But the rumor mill, it instantly attaches these sensory details. The movement, the smell, ensuring the creature itself and the terror associated with it gets permanently lodged in the cultural memory.
Absolutely. So the micro takeaway for this discovery phase has to be the enduring, deeply unnerving power of childhood objects to persist. The item recalled as a defective, dangerous unit was discovered decades later as a silent, apparently living resident. It completely blurred the line between inanimate object and life, and in doing so, it validated the most paranoid suspicions about the 0.1% for the entire country.
Okay, so once the discovery basically confirmed the legend was real, the only path forward for the authorities was achieving that total, unquestionable closure that 1996 failed to deliver. They needed a final, very public ritual of extermination. And that brings us to phase four, the final scapegoat and the cultural residue.
Right. The method chosen for the final disposal, it was reported with, well, the highest level of official fanfare possible under the circumstances. It was clearly meant as an unambiguous signal. This is over. For real this time.
Yeah.
The sources indicate the entity would be exterminated and has remained scattered into the Pacific Ocean as requested.
We have to pause on that. As requested. Requested by whom? The entity. Unlikely. The family. Maybe. Or perhaps it was requested by the system itself, needing a symbolic end. And why the Pacific Ocean? Why not secure incineration, monitored destruction, deep freezing for study? The choice of the deep sea feels fundamentally symbolic, doesn't it? It's an act aiming for total erasure, unretrievable, unstudiable. It's the ultimate expression of, we handled it. It is physically impossible for this specific instance to return or be analyzed further.
It's definitely an attempt to turn what was a systemic failure, the initial recall's incompleteness, into an individual contained tragedy that's now resolved. But we need to look at this final act through that deep dive lens we use, thinking back to Aladdin. Remember how the treasure in that story is often a trap? Something designed to bait you, make you ignore the larger, more dangerous systemic flaw.
Yeah, I see the connection. In the story of the Groagai recall, this discovered entity, the survivor, became the perfect scapegoat. Locating it, capturing it, destroying the scary thing, the 0.1% treasure, they finally found it, allowed everyone to breathe a sigh of relief, as one source put it. The focus shifted entirely away from the original negligence of the manufacturer or the systemic failure of regulation that allowed that dangerous 0.1% to slip through the cracks in the first place.
Precisely. The entity itself became the focus of all the horror and fascination, distracting the public from the underlying trap, the flawed product, the flawed regulatory system. It's always easier, culturally, to process the destruction of a singular monster than it is to conduct a complex, potentially embarrassing investigation into decades of corporate negligence or government oversight failures. A good scare always trumps accountability.
And the immediate cultural aftermath just confirms this mythology cycle playing out. The story instantly cemented its place. It wasn't going away this time. It tied together all those classic cultural strings, toy panic, product recall nightmares, all now fueled by these persistent conspiracy theories about missing units, theories that turned out to be true. The incident didn't fade again. It calcified. It became a permanent, confirmed urban legend.
And that myth, the story of the Groagai, it's permanent now. It lives on far longer than the product itself ever did, certainly longer than the company that made it. This echoes that theme we saw in our Buzz Lightyear analysis, the idea that artifacts, or sometimes just the stories about artifacts, outlive their makers.
Yeah. The physical unit, or at least the potent memory of its silent survival in that bathtub, it outlived the entire advertising campaign, the corporate structure that launched it, the official destruction statement from 96, all of it. The artifact itself, the idea of a toy that grew too real, that survived undetected, is just intrinsically powerful. And the 2026 discovery, it just validated three decades of quiet background anxiety.
Yeah, it demonstrated very publicly that the official history, that confident claim of 99.9% success, was essentially a narrative built on an incomplete and therefore misleading fact. And when the official facts leave a gap that big, that resonant, human curiosity, human fear, collective memory, it will always rush in to fill it with something far more vivid, far more lasting than bureaucratic compliance and premature closure.
Okay, so let's just try and unpack this all one last time for you, the listener. Connect the dots. We've traced this whole narrative arc, right? from the innocent product hype in 1996, through that catastrophic, weirdly vague recall, into a 30-year stretch of uneasy silence and cultural forgetting, culminating in that uncanny, definitive discovery in 2026.
The story of the Groig Eye recall, it's really the perfect illustration of why corporate containment measures often fail in the long run. The regulatory system thought the case was closed, done, 99.9% destroyed, file it away. But that remaining 0.1%, that tiny mathematical flaw, that was the crucial opening. It generated a 30-year narrative of hidden survival and eventually ultimate horrifying discovery.
It just lays bare the vulnerability of the official narrative, doesn't it? Authorities achieved a statistical success, sure, probably a major logistical feat back then, but they failed completely to achieve narrative success. They left that logical loophole, that 0.1%, that human imagination and collective fear could latch onto and exploit for 3 decades, until, incredibly, it manifested back into physical reality.
Mm-hmm. And this story really shows us that in our age of information, maybe especially now, official statements, containment efforts, they often fail, not because the facts they present are outright untrue. Look, they probably did destroy 99.9% of the units, but they fail because those facts are fundamentally incomplete. And that incompleteness, that quantifiable gap, however small, creates the perfect habitat for cultural memory to fill. And it fills it with persistent, vivid, and truly enduring fear.
And sometimes, I guess, the most persistent fear is the one that turns out to have been disturbingly real all along.
A cracked plastic smile, smelling faintly of chlorine. They kept answering back long after the toy aisle closed.